Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Just for Variety. Today is April 3rd, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. My guest today is Nicholas Gazeltine. The 29-year-old British actor is one of Hollywood's hottest rising stars. Fans first really took notice when he starred as Prince Robert opposite Camila Cabello in the 2021 remake of Cinderella. Then he and Sophia Carson made Netflix viewers swoon with their mega-hit romantic drama, Purple Hearts. More swooning came to be playing a Prince of England who falls in love with the son of the U.S. president in Red, White, and Royal Blue. Gazeltine's work in the queer high school comedy Bottoms really showed off his comedic chops. Now, he plays George Villiers in Mary and George. The limited series, premiering April 5th on Starz, follows the true story of George's mother, Mary, portrayed by Oscar winner Julianne Moore, a woman so desperate for money, power, and influence in the highest circles of 17th century England that she successfully pushes her son to become lovers with King James I. And then there is the much-anticipated The Idea of You with Anne Hathaway. Gazeltine plays the lead singer of a boy band who falls in love with an older woman, that would be Hathaway, when she brings her daughter to his band's meet-and-greet at Coachella. Wait till you hear what he says about dancing in his underwear in the movie. Plus, Gazeltine opens up about one of his worst auditions for Dunkirk with Christopher Nolan. But before we get to my conversation with Gazeltine, I have to tell you about Alex Edelman's one-man show, Just For Us. He recently returned to Los Angeles for a weekend run of the show at the Mark Taper Forum. And let me just say, Edelman is genius. He is a genius. In the 90-minute, no-intermission comedy show, he takes audiences on a journey of what it means to be Jewish. The through line? Edelman once attended a meeting of white nationalists in Queens, New York, after his social media was targeted by bigots with vile anti-Semitic rhetoric. Edelman's insight and observations left me laughing out loud for most, if not all, of the show. And the good news is, you can see it too. A filmed version of the show, shot before a live audience at the Hudson Theater in New York City, premieres on HBO on April 6th.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Just for Variety. I first interviewed Nicholas Gazeltine when he played Prince Charming opposite Camila Cabello in the movie musical remake of Cinderella. Since then, he has appeared on Just for Variety for the release of Red, White, and Royal Blue, the queer rom-com based on the best-selling novel of the same name. He caught up last month at the Vanity Fair Oscar party. And now he's here to talk about Mary and George. He stars opposite Julianne Moore and Tony Crimm. It is a steamy, sexy series inspired by true events that brings to mind The Favorite, Bridgerton, The Great, and The Crown. And then later in the show, Gazelstein talks about The Idea of You, his new Oh My God, You're Going to Love It rom-com with Anne Hathaway. And I hope you forgive me if you hear me coughing a little bit during our conversation. Turns out I was coming down with the flu, and I actually had to miss Mary and George's red carpet premiere because I was sick in bed. I caught up with Gazelstein over Zoom video.
How are you, my friend?
Good. Decompressing after a crazy few days in South By, but overwhelmingly humbled, to be honest. I was not expecting like that kind of response. But
I think our headline was South By lost their minds with Nick and Anne.
It was crazy because I was just kind of expecting a couple of people to show up, and you know, we pulled up and there was always that massive line of people, and then, you know, even just like going into the screening, I've never been in a screening with such a reactive audience. I mean, it was like the laughs, the audible gasps, the tears at the end. I mean, and then, you know, like the Q&A, and it was like, it was so incredibly special. And I feel really grateful because, you know, I was supposed to go to South By the year before for Bottoms, and I didn't get to do that. And so to like experience it in that way was unreal.
So this was your first South By?
Yeah, it was my first South By. And I think it's a really unique festival because, you know, they have such a wide array of movies. I mean, they have their sort of art house and they have their kind of four quadrant as well. And, you know, to close it was, yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, I've been a handful of times and I love Austin. I love it so much. Yeah. It's such a great little town.
Yeah.
But they scheduled the Oscars the first weekend of South By, so I couldn't go then. And then after a week of Oscars, I just sleep a lot.
Well, you're so like on for about a week that, I mean, like, I mean, even just doing junkets and stuff for the first time, how that completely saps your energy. Like, I can't imagine for you. I mean, it must be knackering.
It was, but I just keep saying it literally was when I saw you at Vanity Fair. So that was, you know, four days just standing on my feet. And it took me almost a full week to sort of like feel like I had it by a job. But I love it. This is not a complaint. I don't want to ever think I'm complaining about this because it's absolutely amazing. And I pinch myself every time I walk into an Oscar carpet and ask the Vanity Fair. I don't take it, you know, for granted.
How did you feel, you know, this year with all of the, you know, nominated movies and everything like that? Was anything sort of unique you took from this year and interviews and stuff?
I don't know. It just, there was definitely more of an excitement this year. I think this was the first year we really felt like we were back and we weren't sort of like, COVID. Obviously there was the strike, but the fact that the strike was over.
It was extra excitement.
So it was a good year. I had a lot of fun. And now we're off to the races with more premieres like yours.
We are.
So let's start with Mary and George. I mean, we talked before the actor's strike because you were one of my last interviews.
Yeah.
That I did. And I remember you telling me about it. I didn't really know much about it. And what a series. Nick. Wow. When you said he had sex with everyone, you were not kidding.
Listen, I'm a very candid person. And I gave you the hit list. And I think I fulfilled my promise. Look, I mean, obviously that's the sort of headline that many people will talk about, but I think the show is, I mean, it's so nuanced and it's so sort of genre bending in the sense that, you know, it starts out kind of as this like kind of comedy, you know, akin to maybe The Great or The Favourite. And then, you know, where we leave our characters in episode seven, I mean, it's a very different show. So I think just personally, it was so gratifying to be able to perform an arc that was so wide. And that's the benefit of doing something like a limited series that you maybe don't get as much of doing movies. So, no, I feel very personally gratified. I'm very excited to see what the American audiences will think.
Do you have to do a chemistry read with Julianne Moore or with Tony? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, it was so funny how that kind of came about, because, you know, I had read for it a while before I was in pre-production for The Idea of You.
Mm-hmm.
And I went off to do that movie, and that was my entire focus. And then I remember watching Still Alice, which I have no idea why I watched that as like self-care during a like busy shooting schedule. It feels kind of masochistic, but you know, I was watching it and I was thinking, oh God, like I would love to work with Julianne Moore. And literally the next day I get a call from my agent saying, you know, Oliver Hermanis wants to meet with you. And, you know, we just had a conversation over the phone, him and I, and there was like a clear sort of creative connection and just like a human connection. I mean, he and I like immediately became good friends and you know, based off of that conversation, I mean, they offered it to me and, you know, a few weeks later I was meeting with Julie and we were, you know, shooting away. I mean, it was crazy.
What was your first day on set with, I'm not going to call her Julie, I'm going to say Julianne Moore.
I'm sure she wouldn't mind. I mean, in one interview we did recently, she was like, people call her Juju. And I was like, I've never heard anyone call her Juju. I think that goes beyond my remit. But it's the first day on set with, God, what was the first day on set? I feel like we were doing, I mean, it was the scene where I've come back from France, mm-hmm. and was sort of walking in her sort of new inherited home in the gardens, and it was freezing, and I was actually quite sick because I just had a sort of, you know, no break from doing three projects on the bounce, and then having to go off and do fashion stuff and do some reshoots for another project, and two projects actually. But I just remember, she just has this incredible poise about her and this sort of, I mean, she's so affable it's hard to kind of get beyond the fact that she is an icon, but I'd say she's so warm and open and collaborative to the people around her. And I just didn't want to give her a sense that I was like entirely in awe of her, because, you know, because we had to obviously portray this really close relationship. And I think also, you know, having just worked with Anne Hathaway, it kind of like made this sort of process a lot easier, because I'm very lucky. I've worked with some really iconic actresses, you know, and Uma Thurman and Minnie Driver. And so, yeah, it was just, I think we were just so excited about this relationship between mother and son and how conniving and Machiavellian they were.
Did you know anything about this story? Because Mary is a effing piece of work. She's
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the joy of the show really is that historically, there's not so much written about Mary, but we know where she ended up. We know that she was buried in, I think, what's it called? The Abbey. I'm forgetting it now, but like, she's buried amongst kings. You know, she's an important person, but there were so many gaps to fill in. And with George, we know his destructive nature, you know, where he got to, the people he seduced, the wars he waged. This was a man who nothing seemed out of reach to him at the height of his powers. But, you know, similarly, I was more interested in his genesis, like how he became that. What was his sort of time like in France? And so, you know, we were just we were both not sort of schooled coming into the project, but then you know we had some great historical resources, and then obviously like the script from DC Moore, which was just so you know filled with amazing language and opportunity. And I mean, it's interesting because again, you know, Mary is someone who speaks in soliloquies often, and had all of her sort of power kind of exists in her words. And George is much less of that, and it's more in his looks and his physicality and how he. It's much more of a physical performance, I think, and yeah. Mary's is much more sort of verbal, I think, which was very that sort of playing with each other, and the power dynamics of that were very interesting.
Was George the ultimate star fucker?
Well, I mean, yes, but, and until he became the star himself, you know, I mean, he I think, you know, one, his sort of voracious appetite and his fluidity and, you know, in many ways, his sort of ever-changing sense of identity allowed him to kind of cross all of these boundaries. But then, yeah, I mean, he got entirely seduced by the doors that this power could open. And so, you know, there were things even within the show that we didn't even have time to include. I mean, he very famously bedded the Queen of France as well. You know, he goes off to Spain and still his appetites are not quenched. And that kind of obviously led to quite a destructive final chapter of his life.
Are you a royal watcher? Are you someone who gets into the royals?
Not really. I think that's kind of symptomatic of my generation and you know, growing up in the UK. But, you know, especially this kind of time period, there's just so much inherent drama with it. And the royal court was such a place of intrigue and you know, politics and gossip. And
it feels like it's the same today. I mean, yeah. Now everyone's searching for Kate Middleton. Like that's...
It's so funny. I guess I've just been so in press world. I mean, I had no idea so much going on. But no, there is just, I think, and what's exciting about this show, you know, to foreign audiences is I think there is this sort of international fascination with yeah. this family and this lineage. And there's something just very almost fantastical about this world, and though it's based in history, you know, it feels heightened and exciting.
Is it time to get rid of the royals? Does the UK need them?
I am not classified to make any such grand statements, but I don't know. I mean, they're certainly entertaining. I was.
I mean, it's just when I was watching it, you know, I was thinking about George. If it's modern times, would George be an influencer and that's how he would get into the court? Like, you can't help but look at like what the, you know, the modern day
yeah.
are. And then obviously we're constantly hearing about this one, sleeping with that one, sleeping with this one. And then I was getting very confused because I was doing a deep dive. I'm like, wait a minute, which James is this?
Yeah.
I'm so confused.
Well, there's so many. There's James's and there's Charles's and there's, you know, there's Henry's and you know, it's interesting what you said before. I think the thing that it is so impactful about, you know, obviously there's a lot more accessibility in the modern age we live in. The fact that no one in like over like hundreds of years had ever climbed from such a low social standing to essentially, you know, being the King of England. And we see a lot of symmetry towards the end of the show. And, you know, there's that the scene that I so love in Spain where one of the Spanish dignitaries asks him, you know, like, how is it that they give you so much power? He says, but I take it. Like, I am the power. I am the king. I'm England. You know, for all intents and purposes, I mean, we see historically, Charles, you know, James's son, ends up getting executed because the country had fallen into such disarray, largely due to George's machinations, you know, thinking of himself as this hero, kind of like Sir Walter Raleigh. I mean, that was one of his idols. You know, he goes off and he does all these expeditions in Spain and in France, and expeditions in all senses of the word, you know. And so, you know, it's funny. I mean, obviously the show has such a explosive ending, but I mean, the real history, there's even more.
Of course.
And life is stranger than fiction in some ways. I mean, it's really it was just so, it's such an ease that we like had all of this material to really play with as actors.
Do you tell your family like, hey, before you watch this, you need to know?
Yeah, well, it's funny because they were at the premiere with me in the UK and I was kind of in hysterics because, you know, there is nothing more uncomfortable than watching your son bed a number of characters even within the first few episodes. But honestly, I think the way they were shot and the fact that they're all very purposeful in terms of finding out who George is and how he was able to dominate people, and I think that's, you know, one of Oliver's real strengths is making these scenes feel really integral to the plot and not just salacious, but
because George is sleeping with people with an intent.
Yeah,
it is. Everything has a purpose.
And this, you know, the relationship between him and King James is really conflicting because, you know, Tony and I talked at length, you know, that we do believe that there was love there. There was a genuine connection, but but George's appetite couldn't be satiated, and it certainly is completely transactional at first. And I think, you know, it's been really gratifying to read people watching these scenes and it not feeling, you know, comparatively to something like The Idea of You, like really sexy and romantic and whatever, like these scenes, they almost carry the intensity of an action scene, I think, with them in some way. George is very laser focused, and that dominating energy, I think, is really something I try to channel as well.
Yeah, I think it was in, I think it's the episode seven, I think, when Charles says something to Mary about your relationship with the king, and Mary says, like, and I'm paraphrasing, basically, there's only one person that George loves, and it's George himself.
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people have interpreted that quite differently as well. And I won't say really what that means and really what the truth is, because, you know, you see George earlier on in the story, and I'd say particularly his relationship with his brother John and how extremely protective he is of him. And some would say, you know, Mary's doings killed off the last parts of humanity in George. You know, I think seeing his first love maimed, seeing John sent away, there's that wonderful face-off where Mary confronts George about his actions, in particular one person perishing who I won't name, but you know, he says, she says, this is not how I raised you. And, you know, he says, I mean, this is, I am exactly what you made me. That's the thing is, and the joy of George is that, you know, he is so sweet and tender when we first meet him. And you know, maybe a tad melodramatic, but he's entirely what Mary makes him. And she has to accept some responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you want to say to Mary, careful what you wish for.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's that brilliant final scene where, you know, there is an emptiness. She's achieved and accrued so much, but it kind of doesn't feel the same without George.
You talked about your mom seeing you at the premiere. What did your parents say to you when you came home and said, I want to be an actor?
Well, it all happened so fast that I think it was almost like too quickly for them to process. I mean, it was like me joining the circus, really, in a way. And like my parents both came from, relatively little and are such brilliant, intelligent people and worked so hard. And there was, their son who'd committed a lifetime to sports and that didn't work out. And then suddenly it was like, I'm going to do something equally unstable or even more so, to be honest. But I think the fact that I had booked sort of the lead role in the first movie and then sort of every role following was like one of the lead roles, they kind of started to grow in confidence. And then I think when I started working with the likes of Uma Thurman and Pierce Brosnan and now we're at a point where it was so heartwarming. I mean, my mum, she's always like a typical Greek mother. She's always really worried about, the instability of this job. But she was very emotional at the premiere, and I think just very proud that I'd kind of come this far really with no training or anything like that. And I consider myself very, very lucky. I think that's obviously a large part of it, but also I'd like to think work ethic too. And it's just the joy to be able to do something that I'm so passionate about as a job, because I think you and I can both agree, what we do for work is incredible, and the fact that we get to be in this creative space is so lucky.
How long were you auditioning before you booked that first movie?
That was my first audition. Yeah, it was just crazy. I literally went. I Which is funny, Mark, because after that movie, I was like, oh, it's gonna be easy from here on out. I'm just gonna be working every, but I literally went from having never acted in my life to being the lead in a movie within the space of 2 months, and
But
it was just...
where did this come from? Like, did you tell your mom I'm going to go audition for this movie?
Yeah, there was the Edinburgh Fringe Festival was really the sort of the big thing. I almost didn't go. My dad had to convince me to go along. I still didn't know what my grades were going to be for my final year of high school. I found out in Edinburgh that they weren't that great. And then off the back of that play, an agent wanted to sign me, and so it was. Did the play for 2 weeks in Edinburgh, went down to London, signed with them, went on my first audition, booked the lead role, and then was starring opposite, the late Luke Perry in that first micro budget indie. And so, I think the thing that really kept me on the straight and narrow was I was doing a lead role in a film at least once every year for the first few years of my career. And so I had something to kind of keep motivating me. And they, there was a point where I was not being paid anything really to be able to support myself with these roles. Despite actually a few of them really kind of going around, like Handsome Devil went to the Toronto Film Festival, and all the while I was doing these lead roles and then working part time for the majority of the year. I was a caterer. I was working in Abercrombie and Fitch. I was working in a frozen yogurt store. I
Wait,
know
tell
that
me
was a
about your Abercrombie life.
The low point in my life, but I was very desperate for money. And look, my parents, I'm
Did
really
you have
glad.
to wait? Did you have to
Oh
stand in front of
no,
the
I
door
didn't.
shirtless?
That was a line. I was like, I'm not willing for that to be on the internet forever. So I say, while I take all of my clothes off and marry George. No, I my parents instilled a really great work ethic in me, and they were like, well, look, if you're going to pursue this, you are entirely financially responsible for yourself. And I think it led to me developing a really good work ethic that I think has been really useful in the last few years.
So were you a salesman at Abercrombie and
I was a
Fitch?
salesman. I was a frozen yogurt salesman as well. I was also a Manny for a few years. I was a football coach. I was doing like multiple jobs at the same time. It was really, and it was hard because I mean I knew I was really passionate about this thing, but it was just so frustrating that I couldn't do it all the time. And I kind of dreamed of being in a day where I could go project to project, and that's what my last couple of years have been like. And it's just it.
Have you heard from any of your old Manny clients?
Yeah, I have actually. I weirdly enough went back home. for the holidays, and I bumped into the kids who are now like, you know, these almost adults, and I'm like, it's very, you know, because I think this industry moves so quickly that time can kind of go by extremely fast, and but you know, life is happening around you, and it was very funny to see some of my old clients.
What did you know of Luke Perry when you booked it? Were you familiar?
Very little. I mean 90210 was a little bit before my time, yeah. but I knew he was this icon, and I think, you know, was going through a really rough period because he had been this heartthrob for many, many years, and then a little bit out of work for a while, and then, you know, he was off working with this first timer in London with, you know, on a $500,000 budget movie. And so, you know, I'm not entirely sure what he sort of thought of the whole process, but I think what was really lovely to see is, you know, in his sort of final years is, you know, he had much more job stability. He went on Riverdale and he was in the Tarantino movie. And I think it was a really, you could see he was kind of really getting back into it, which for me was just really lovely to kind of see.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Gazelfine talks about how Tom Cruise influenced his performance in The Idea of You. And he also reveals what happened with Christopher Nolan at his, well, disastrous audition for Dunkirk. Welcome back to Just for Variety. I'm Mark Malkin. In The Idea of You, Nicholas Gazaltine plays Hayes Campbell, the lead singer of a boy band who falls in love with Celine, an older woman who he meets when she brings her daughter to his band's meet and greet at Coachella. Yes, many a headline claimed that Gazaltine has channeled Harry Styles for the role. We didn't get into that here because last month he told me at the Vanity Fair Oscar party that Hayes is his own character and does not exist in the One Direction universe. Are you nervous of fame? Are you scared of this fame thing?
Look, I think there are certain non-negotiables in my life of how I want to live it. And I think that, it will just be about negotiating what I can do and what I can't do, and just trying to remain as true to myself. I know I have a really wonderful community of people around me, but it's been adjustment. It's been an adjustment the last year or so, especially being so perceivable, I suppose, in public. But I've mostly had really positive experiences, and I think it's just a testament to people appreciating the work that I'm putting out, which is lovely to see.
I mean, I couldn't help, but, you know, I saw The Idea of You yesterday. It's so good. But I'm watching, you know, the paparazzi after Hayes and all of that fame. And I was thinking of you, like, this is it. You know, this is happening. You know, I see your fan base, you know, on social, as, you know, we joke about it, but they are passionate. And I have to imagine, you've got to be a little nervous. You've got to be like, what's my private life and what's my...
Yeah. I mean, look, I would say, like I said before, I mean, most everyone has been really respectful of me and, you know, the privacy I like to curate. Usually won't see me being, you know, in places that I feel like are not purposeful. Mm. I think everything that I've sort of done recently all feels directly correlated to my work, which I think is the most important thing, because I think as actors, we have to maintain some level of mystique so people are able to see us in all of these different roles being different people. And so that's very important to me. But I mean, look, it's only something I can possibly know once I experience it. And you know, to have worked with two Oscar winners back to back and who've experienced that for decades now, I feel like I have a community of really knowledgeable people who are just helping me traverse it all. And very lucky to have that.
But just to play a little more devil's advocate, how do you date? How do you, again, you know, like I think about this all the time. I don't know why this is an example I always think about, but like Jennifer Aniston, she can't really sit at an outdoor cafe and have dinner.
Yeah. I mean, look, the personal side of it, it can be tricky at times, you know, I found my girlfriend in a really, you know, natural way. And but, you know, in the past, it's been difficult just because of the transience of the job. And but it's kind of what I was saying before, Mark. It's like like no one's going to stop me from walking around London. Like that's my city. I love being in that world. And I think it's just about trying to bring some level of humanity. You know, that there's been times where I've just really not wanted to sort of stop and take pictures and stuff. And I think all it takes is just having a really respectful conversation with some people and them seeing you as a person. And look, maybe this is speaking from a position of naivety right now, and there will be things that will have to change. But for now, it's totally manageable, and most importantly, you know, it's been all about the work, and the work that's in the future is very exciting, and yeah, that's what I'm here for.
So the idea of you dancing in your black little underwear, is that your answer to Tom Cruise and Risky Business? Because that's what I thought.
It's funny. That was like kind of one of the references in my head. I think that's my favorite scene actually in the whole movie, because I think so much about what is talked about with this movie is obviously the kind of the more intimate scenes. But really, I think the most powerful expression of love is the aftercare in a way, and the connection after. And I love the scene where we're lying in bed and I'm ordering the room service, and Michael Showalter was just like, every time I was just dryly, I mean, the actual scene, the longest version of the scene, he had me like listing things for about like 2 minutes that we wanted to order. And Michael's cackling from the other room, because you go from like the really heightened high energy to the just extremely normal, which I love. And it's like, that's what we don't know about these, you know, these people, these superstars, is we want to see them in their most sort of candid moments. And, you know, I think the most important thing about falling in love with someone is embracing each other's oddities, and, you know, they're little weirdos together. They're dancing around using room service as microphones and cigarettes. And, yeah, Michael really just let us play, with each other. And I'm so grateful for that, because I think Annie and I just have a natural, chemistry with each other. We're just very good at like having fun with each other, I think.
I love when she just said, "and the cookie plate."
Exactly. It was so funny. He just let us kind of go with that. And she's such a good improviser as well. I kind of didn't know that before our chemistry test. And then we ended up doing this, it's like a 7-8 page scene where we just went completely off script at one point and were really like just vibing with each other. I think people don't know. I mean, they obviously know she's an incredible dramatic actor, but they don't know how funny she is as well. She's really funny.
I know you've said your favorite boy band was Backstreet Boys.
Look, I was more, truthfully, I was more into just bands in general. Like I grew up on the Stones and
that's, know, a little different than Backstreet
Boys. Yeah, I wouldn't call them the boy. But to be fair, my sister was the avenue by which I kind of found music. And so the Backstreet Boys were presented to me at one point. And there was a definite sense of, oh, like, this is cool. This little fraternity is like, you know, I was never a dancer or anything like that. But the corniness of it all, I mean, it's just irresistible, to be honest. And I felt that on stage, you know. These really felt like actual concerts, you know, because these supporting actors, they'd show up, there was about 500 of them, you know, by day two they knew all of our names, they knew all of the lyrics to the songs, the crew got involved as well, and so, you know, you're walking up those stage stairs and it's like doing a concert. And you know, there's one bit where I sort of dive down into the pits and I'm being sort of tugged at different angles, and you know, I by the end of day three, albeit it was, you know, 3 a.m. in late spring in Atlanta, freezing cold, we just kind of wanted to keep going with it. And you know, had it been more Hayes' story rather than Selene's, you know, I'm sure we would have been able to kind of dive into that more. But, you know, it was all obviously in support of this central relationship between the two of us.
So whose video, which group's videos did you watch to sort of get that boy band?
It's yeah, there's so many different references really, because actually from the sort of dancing choreography perspective, BTS was used a lot because they have this kind of effortless nonchalance, but still really being able to hit the choreography. And I always reiterate, I am not a dancer. I tried my best over having a few weeks of rehearsal. But these are skills that are honed for the rest of for the majority of people's lives. And my boy band members are all professional dancers. So I said, listen, you little shit, you better not make me look bad. Okay. Yeah, I mean, there was just so many different people. And I think really they just kind of let us be together and socialize. We were all in this hotel together, and we would hang out every single day. And I think the thing that's really palpable with these bands is seeing the brotherhood that kind of exists on stage and the banter. And I think that's something the movie captured really well.
How many hours a day were you in makeup for your tattoos?
Oh God, it's so funny. I mean, we actually got a really great we got it down to like a great, I think it was like maybe like an hour, but it was so funny actually, because when I went off after Idea of You to do Mary and George, the makeup department on that show were panicking because the picture they'd been sent of me was with all of the tattoos, and they thought, how on earth are we going to cover these things every single day while he's taking his clothes off? But no, I mean it was that was a really fun part of the character building process is finding what do these tattoos say about him, and most of which like they don't, there's no sort of, they're never referenced in the film or anything like that. But I think costume, hair and makeup really are integral in creating something that feels unique, and also is just very like, what makes him look pop star-y, and what makes him look not that, because we kind of find out later on that Hayes doesn't really want to be a pop star, I think, in that way.
One of the things that Hayes says is, my greatest fear in life is that I'm a joke. What's your greatest fear?
I think just I think being misunderstood. I think I think the I mean Hayes kind of references this in a lot of ways. I think the reality is oftentimes so different. That's why when he talks about not being Hayes Campbell, it's like there's so much more behind the name, and oftentimes I think I've had to accept that, my narrative is kind of completely out of my control, really. And anyone can say anything they really want about you, regardless of truth, and you kind of have to be okay with that. I think, like I said, it always comes back to the work and doing good work, and then it comes back to people who are not in the industry, community. But that's something I've had to like really work out over the years, is being out of control of my narrative, and potentially being misunderstood, and being okay with that in some ways.
Do you remember, some bizarre internet rumor that was just the wildest one you've ever read about yourself?
I mean, truth be told, I really I stay off the internet because I don't think it just doesn't serve me really in any ways. And I've had to be so active the last month or two with these couple of projects. But well, okay, I'll tell you something that was really funny, which is professional. But one of the few times I logged onto my Twitter, I looking at my notifications, and I saw everyone was saying that I had been chosen to play Johnny Flame in the Fantastic Four. And it was funny because there had been conversations that had been had, but I knew for a fact it was Joseph Quinn, who I know and I think is brilliant. And it was like this awkward thing of like, I clicked on the tweet and there's like 20K likes, and I'm like, oh God, like I wish I could just like put a stop to this, because Joseph had been mentioned as well, and he's gonna absolutely, kill that role. I think he's so talented. But I think that's the funny thing is it's just the constant stream of people supposedly signing contracts to be attached to certain things. And let me tell you, the majority of the time, it's not true. So that's another reason to stay off the internet, is to not believe that, you know, your team haven't told you that you've been wrong and you're finding it out via Twitter.
Did you text your team going, did I get the role?
Yeah, it was a funny thing. I was like, guys, I have to, I'm sure it's not true, but I have to make certain it's not true, right? And they go, yeah, it's not true. But like I said, I mean, I'm really excited for wonderful cast, actually, you know, Pedro Pascal as well. And so, but yeah, not this time.
What has been your worst audition? What could you tell me?
Oh God, bad auditions. I mean, I recently, Julie and I were talking in one of the junkets about, I had to audition for Young Tarzan, and I had to improvise this scene where I'm like protecting an orange. And at the time I just wasn't confident enough to go all out. And I just came off as this sort of very feeble, just socially awkward person, as opposed to this man who'd kind of been raised by apes. That one lived in my memory for a long, long time. I actually, I got very far in the Dunkirk process, and so much so that I met with Christopher Nolan. And I remember, I mean, he's one of my, you know, filmmaking idols. And I remember being so excited for this audition. And we had this little preamble, but he's, you know, he likes to kind of get down to business. And so he starts reading the scene, and it's not the scene that I prepared. And so he's getting into it. And I'm like, I'm fully prepared to start improvising, because I was like, to me at the time, that was like the only way. this is some sort of test. And it gets to my line, and I'm just staring at him for like what feels like an eternity, and I like finally plucked up the courage to kind of, it almost felt sacrilegious to say, I'm sorry, Christopher Nolan, you have the wrong scene. Or I'd just been royally screwed up by my team. But luckily I said that to him, and it was a mistake, because there was multiple of these sort of, you know, dummy sides to reading. But that was almost the most mortifying moment of my acting career in front of one of my idols. I was frozen. But yeah. Luckily, I mean, and went to some fantastic actors eventually. So, yeah.
How nervous was it singing in front of Anne Hathaway?
I mean, that was definitely nerve-wracking, but I would say it was less nerve-wracking than having to convince her to dance, because, you know, at least I had my guitar, and Annie reminded me of this the other day, but I'd actually, there was a song that was suggested that I prepare, which I kind of vetoed, because I didn't think it actually served the character and who he was as an artist. And I think that actually really helped me make an impression, because I think it let them know that I had a sort of deeper understanding, I think, of who he was. And that one really, it went over so well, and so much so, you know, I remember Annie kind of singing along with me, and a few of the people in the audition room just kind of vibing with it, which was cool. But then, yeah, the dance was so daunting as well, because I brought Always All Right by Alabama Shakes, which I think is just really fun. And I just remember pulling out some like horrible dance moves, which kind of was the point. It was like, let's have that youthful, loving energy together. And then I think we also redid the dance again with Dance All Days, which obviously ended up in the movie as well. But I mean, honestly, Mark, like I don't think I've ever been as present in an audition as I was in that one. I mean, it was truly one of those remarkable times where you don't expect you're going to have that much chemistry with someone, and leaving the audition hall, I was thinking to myself, you know, God, I really, really want this, but if I don't get it, I'm so proud of myself, because oftentimes those rooms are just terrifying. You know, it's so not human and not conducive to creativity. And, yeah. and I felt like I'd kind of gotten past it all, which was, you know, obviously then to get the call the next day and they wanted me, which is...
What was the wrap party like for the idea? Do I feel like, because we know Anne likes to dance. We just saw her dancing in Milan or Paris or something.
Me and Annie had a little dance. We all had a little dance together, which was fun. I mean, it was such a fun movie to make, but it was, it felt like a long filming process actually in Atlanta. And, you know, at that point I was just exhausted because I'd already done a couple of movies. And you know, I knew I was going on to the next thing as well, but, it was just such a wonderful crew. I mean, I really love, you know, the Atlanta film community. They were all, I think that was one thing I really like to do on set is just create a sense of community. I think it really helps, push through all of those really long nights and, you know, it's really special. So many of the crew came out from Atlanta to Austin to watch the movie, and it was like, you know, I haven't seen these people in a year, and I'm so grateful to all of them, and it made some really lasting friendships to this day, which is great.
When we were at on the Vanity Fair carpet, you told me you would love to work with Emily Blunt. Did you get to chat with her inside Vanity Fair?
Honestly, it was such a chaotic of just like so many incredible people that like I never even saw her. I was joking with the interviewer because, you know, I'm collecting my Infinity Stone actresses. You know, if they decide to do a second Devil Wears Prada, I will be the assistant. I will run the coffee around.
But what you don't know, Nick, is I was in Devil Wears Prada.
You wait, what?
I am in Devil Wears Prada.
Wait, which bit? Hold on. I need to go back and watch. Were you like, are you on camera?
Don't blink. I'm on camera. No speaking. So basically what happened was when Devil Wears Prada started shooting, I had just moved to LA. Mm. So I was still part of the New York, you know, I was part of the New York media scene for about a decade. Yeah. And the producers wanted to put all these people in a party scene that were like Easter eggs to New York media.
I love that.
She goes, I think it's when Anne goes to the gallery or a party and meeting the blonde. And I'm always like, Simon West, is that his name? Yeah. She's meeting him and you see me going back and forth.
the way they send extras, just like keep crossing frames. It's the same guy we've seen 16 times.
Literally, that's what I was doing, just going back and forth.
Well, I think we need to do a rewatch just to judge your acting.
The hair is much bigger.
Oh, is it? Is this your only credit to date, or do you plan to sort of bolster your...
So that I have that. I've done and I want to talk to you about RuPaul's Drag Race, but RuPaul's Drag Race I was on in the early seasons as part of challenges.
Yeah.
That gets a lot of hype. And then I did Fit on the Roof in sixth grade.
Again, another impressive credit.
I was Tevye.
Maybe you need a career change. You know, maybe there's a second wind you have as an actor.
I've done a lot of inner child work, Nick. It comes up. But I wanted, because I saw your Instagram, you regrammed a story from Michelle Visage talking about Bob and how much you love Bob. Are you a Drag Race fan?
Well, it's so funny. I mean, I never was. And then my sister is like a huge, huge fan. And I remember, I mean, we were living together at a period in time. And, you know, I was making something in the kitchen at one point. I like walked past and I sat down. I was like entirely engrossed by it. I think like, these people are so incredibly talented. Oh my God. Whether it's just dancing, performing, the sort of humor aspect of it, the makeup they put on the costume. I mean, it's honestly, it's really wonderful. And, you know, my sister's really into, she's getting into the UK season as well. And I was so, it's funny, I just texted her a screenshot of that, and she's freaking out. Like she's very much living vicariously through me at the moment, which
we got to be a judge on the show, Nick.
Listen, I have no expertise whatsoever, so I'm not sure what the classification is, but
you don't need expertise. It's about entertainment and fun.
I love it. I mean, I had some favorites as well from the season that I watched. Crystal Method, I really thought was so cool. Oh, so really funny enough, one of the costumers on Purple Hearts was a drag queen, and he was saying to me, he gave us all drag names, and he said,
drag name.
Mine would be Anita Greencard, which I think is, as a Brit in the US, it's pretty apt. But you know, funnily enough, you know, we on Mary and George, we had this this day where it was snowing torrentially, and we could not get out to film, and so we were stuck in this makeup trailer for hours. So, you know, the makeup artists were so talented under Paul Gooch's leadership, who's fantastic makeup artist. They my costumer and I, she became a drag king, I became a drag queen, and we sort of did the makeup for a few hours, and I kind of went around tormenting people.
Wait a minute, where are the photos?
I'm sure they're online somewhere, because I think they were, I can't remember, they were posted at some point, but God, I mean, it's so much joy. And again, I have to say, like, the talent and the time that it goes into doing
this, it's incredible.
I have so much respect for them.
Well, Nick, this was awesome.
Love chatting to you, Mark. See you soon, mate.
That was Nicholas Gazelsheet. And that's it for this episode of Just for Variety. Thanks for listening. I'll actually be back in a couple of days with another episode featuring a conversation with George MacKay. The 1917 star has two movies on the horizon, the queer revenge thriller slash love story Femme and the science fiction romantic drama La Bête or The Beast. Until then, make sure to follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And for all breaking and exclusive Hollywood news, go to Variety.com. That's it for now. See you later.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.